From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And, of course, along with your calls, some topics to talk about.
Zorba. Yes, binge drinking and smoking dope in older Americans. What is that doing to their bodies? Mm. Shocking, isn't it? Shocking.
I'll older be paying attention to that.
Yes, you will, as an older American, exactly. And then we're going to talk about brain loss post-surgery in people, new information that was published in the British Medical Journal that I think is very, very important when we look at older adults and when we look at the development of Alzheimer's and dementia and IQ loss.
And what's our recipe?
Turkey hummus sliders. Finally, there's a slider that's healthy. It's not just a White Castle slider that I happen to love, although I rarely eat them. This is a turkey hummus slider.
Okay. Coming up to the phones now, though, at 800-462-7413, 1-800-462-7413. Welcoming our first caller now, Zorba, a listener in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, how can we help?
Well, I've been struggling for a while with insomnia, in the sense that I don't struggle so much falling asleep, but I'll typically wake up around 3 or 4 in the morning, and I'm wide awake, and there's nothing I could do about it. So I mentioned this to my family doctor, and she prescribed trazodone, which I've been taking daily. And I guess my concern is I don't know how long I want to be taking a sleeping pill. I don't know if it's safe to continue to take this forever or if I should try to wean myself off.
Well, first of all, that was a good choice. A bad choice would be Ambien. Ambien, you know, is in a class similar to called benzodiazepines. It tends to have a withdrawal, and people tend to be habituated with it. Trazodone is actually an antidepressant, which we often use for sleep because of the side effect of sleepiness. How old are you?
I'm 45.
45. And when did it start, or tell me a little bit, started how long ago?
Probably about 3 or 4 years ago, it became a little bit more acute, and that is coincident with the birth of my son. So my sleeping pattern changed a little bit then, you know.
So wait a minute, time out for a second. The birth of your son and a new baby in the house, and you have insomnia, and you think this is abnormal? No.
Well, I think there's a lot of things that are abnormal, but no, I'm mainly just concerned about the longevity of taking this.
No, I've got that. I do have that. So let's talk a little bit about sleep hygiene. What do you do for a living?
I'm a hydrologist for the federal government.
Okay. And what do you do for exercise?
A lot of hiking, some biking, and that's the main thrust of it.
Okay, so hiking and biking and stuff. How much caffeine do you drink?
Daily, about 2 to 3 cups of coffee.
Okay, so a few cups of coffee. Oh, and when is the last time you have your caffeine, you know, during the daytime usually?
Yeah, I'll typically try to cut myself off by about 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. So first of all, let me give one thing about caffeine, because some people are very caffeine sensitive. Step number one, for a while, 2 to 4 weeks, cut out all the caffeine. Yes, you'll be a little sluggish. You may go through withdrawal. You may actually get a headache. It's not a lot of caffeine, but I would wipe out the caffeine. See if caffeine is part of the issue. And I would also, at the same time you're going to do that, I would stop the trazodone. You may not sleep for a few days. When you stop the trazodone, what's going to happen is you're going to have a side effect of having fragmented sleep just from not using the trazodone for 3 to 5 days. If you did nothing else, you would have fragmented sleep. But I would do both at one time. I'd stop the caffeine, which may help you. I would stop the trazodone, which won't help you. And I would realize I'm going to wake up during the nighttime. Don't get frustrated. Wake up during the night and do that. Now, when you wake up during the night, what I would recommend is you have a radio or something next to your bed, or you have a Kindle. And when you wake up at night, you put on, not the radio, but you put on, go get Audible or go to the library, look at the library, and look at books that you can get out of the library that are on tape. They're not on tape. They're on your iPhone. And what you do, or they're on a recorder that you have. And when you wake up during the night, you put a little earphone in your ear, and you listen to something boring like Confucius. and you listen to what Confucius had to say, you know, something that would put you to sleep at school. I'm not talking about algebra, you know, which you might have to concentrate on, but something like Confucius. So you may go then back to sleep. And I'm serious about this. It's another way that people deal with awakenings in the middle of the night. Now, what you should not do is go look at a blue screen on a computer and then read. A Kindle is different. It has a different screen. And you won't wake up your wife, assuming that she's still sleeping with you because you're waking up in the middle of the night, which is another matter. We won't talk about that. That's more than fragmented sleep. But getting back to the issue, that's one of the things. So, and I'm going to go through a few things with insomnia. Number one, cut out the caffeine 100%. See if that matters. Number two, stop the trazodone. Give it 2 to 3 weeks, and you will be sluggish a bit. You might even find you have to have a little tea in the middle of the day. But see if caffeine is the issue. If so, we're one and done. Number two, trazodone is not lifetime. People take it on and off, and if it works, you stick with this. I have people in my practice, I give them something called gabapentin, which we use for chronic pain. It's an anti-epileptic drug, works well for sleep. Doxepin is another drug that we often use, similar to trazodone. And usually what you want to do is you want to stay in it for a while, and then you want to see if you need it. You're exactly right. You don't want to make it a lifetime thing. But for some people, it is a lifetime thing. And they go, I feel much better. I wake up. I'm refreshed. And these drugs are not really habit-forming. They're not drugs of abuse. And so for some people, staying on it really is the right answer. But I would, okay. I would try those other things first.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Does your 4-year-old wake you up in the middle of the night?
No, he did the first 2 years. He was actually a pretty tough sleeper for the first couple of years, but now he sleeps like a charm.
Now he sleeps like a charm, and you're the toughest. You're the one who wakes up.
Right. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, try this out and let us know.
Yeah, I appreciate your help. Yeah, okay. I will.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Zorba, before our next call, binge drinking among older Americans.
Yeah, stoner seniors. That's what we should call them, stoner seniors. Some interesting things. So before we get into the booze aspect, I want to talk about something that's going on. As you know, the state of Washington, the state of Colorado, the state of Massachusetts, the state of Illinois, they're all legalizing marijuana, much to the chagrin of the federal government that still puts it in the same class as heroin. Marijuana is not in the same class of heroin. It's more likely to be, should be in the same class as alcohol, something we should control, we should tax, we should, and my point, we should make legal and deal with it just like we deal with alcohol, the major inebriant of our society. It turns out when they do research, when they have done research in Colorado and in Washington State, because the fear was once you make it legal, all of these 18 and 19-year-olds are going to go and get stoned more. And the answer is no. 18 and 9-year-olds were getting stoned all along. And they don't, just because it's legal, they're not getting stoned more. But senior citizens are consuming more. And then some of them are getting in their car and driving, thinking that they're actually safe to drive.
Not a good idea.
Not a good idea, bad idea. And this comes, this particular study that came out really is talking about booze. More than 1 in 10 Americans now binge drink. And binge drinking is basically men and women taking more than 4 to 5 drinks at a time. And binge drinking has become much more common. The study shows that basically about 70% that is responsible for lots of hospitalizations, and it's gone up. It's gone up in the last few years. The findings of the study showed that about 70% of older people and 50% of nursing home residents at some point have had major alcohol-related problems. Hmm. So in other words, it actually is a public health problem in seniors. So why is it? Well, first of all, when you're 18 and you have 3 or 4 drinks, you're better at walking, you're better at standing, you're really better at knowing what your limits are in some case. Seniors will get up and fall on the ground and fracture their hip because they think they're 18 and they can have 3 or 4 drinks. But it's an issue that we don't look at from a public health point of view.
Do you have any idea why older people would consume more booze?
Well, they're consuming more booze because they like it, because they feel like they can drink
more
booze.
But if they didn't like it 20 years ago, why would they like it now?
Well, we're not looking at whether or not they actually were bingers 20 years ago. This study didn't look at that. It might be that the 1 in 10 who are actually now engaging in binge drinking, engaged more in binge drinking when they were 18 and 19 and 20 years ago. In other words, we're not looking at this as the study didn't show whether or not this was a new habit. And frankly, if you're 75 years old, how much much do you remember about when you were 18 years old? You might remember when you fell down, seriously.
Well, you'd certainly remember if you were a drinker that you...
I think you would remember if you were a problem drinker, but if you were associated with other people and you went out on Friday and Saturday night and you had four or five drinks and that was part of it, you wouldn't... I don't know what you would remember. But I want to go back because mm-hmm. the study actually didn't show whether or not this is a new problem or it's resurfacing of a problem. Mm-hmm. The study really talks about the fact that we doctors have to ask patients, how often do you binge drink? Now, it's very interesting. In Wisconsin, I'll ask people, how much do you drink? And they'll say, I'm not drinking as much as I used to. I don't know what that means. So I had a guy in my office probably about 3 or 4 months ago, mm-hmm. and he said, I'm not drinking as much on the weekend. I said, how much are you drinking? He said, well, I'll sit down and have four or five drinks. I said, that's kind of a lot. He said, well, back in the day when I was at Eau Claire, I'd sit down on a Saturday, and I'd drink like, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 beers. And I go, 15 or 20 beers? How do you get that much? How much do you get that much fluid in your body? I mean, do you have a portable potty next to you all the time? He said, I don't know. That's what I used to do. So his concept was that five drinks was not a binge drink. The idea is actually we think that four or five drinks now mm-hmm. medically actually is a binge drink. I mean, if you do it over a 12 or 24-hour period, it's one thing. If you do it 4 or 5 hours while you're watching the Packers, you know, play football, it becomes a different issue. For seniors, the issue is this often ends up in a fall, in a break, in a fracture, mm-hmm. and we've got to become more aware of it as doctors. It's not just immunizations that count when you go to the doctor's office or the shingles vaccine. It's how much booze do you drink at one time, and are you a stoner on the weekends? Mm-hmm.
I'll have to remember all of that for when I get old.
That's right, Tom.
Have to be really,
when you grow up, yeah, you'll have to remember
years
all
down
that
the
stuff.
Line.
There we go.
I'll have to be very,
we got
very
it, baby.
Careful.
We got it.
800-462-7413 is our number. That's 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Rutledge, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, my 13-year-old grandson struggles with ADHD and loss of appetite. At his last checkup, he was in the 25th percentile for height and the 10th percentile for weight. He can't get along without it at school, but he doesn't get hungry till 7:30 at night, and he's a fussy eater. And so, you know, we're concerned about the long-term effects, but also we want to know how we can help him and wonder if there's a safe way to stimulate his appetite.
So he's a fussy eater. Let's talk about that. Has he been a fussy eater his whole life?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. What's he like to eat, bacon?
Oh, bacon, French fries.
Uh-huh.
You know, and now he's eating hamburgers. Mm-hmm. You know, and he'll have an egg, scrambled egg. Uh-huh. You know, but it's like feeding the baby bird.
So his mom and dad, so are they thin? Are they heavy? Are they overweight? Tell me about the parents.
His mom is, you know, pretty average for her. Mm-hmm. You know, she's not.
Yeah.
She works out at CrossFit, so she's in really good shape.
Uh-huh. And the dad?
He's heavier, but he, you know, they're not together. I don't really see him at all.
So were they thin when they were younger? That's an important issue.
His mom was.
His mom thin. Was. Okay.
Yeah.
And the mom is your kid, right? His mom.
Yeah.
So she was thin when she was growing up and she was his age?
She was just the average kid. You know, she just ate pretty much, whatever.
So, because one of the things, ADHD medicines can attenuate appetite. Okay, so 25th percentile for height, 10th percentile for weight, that can be actually normal for a child. I mean, that's not necessarily not at all. That's not necessarily abnormal. There are a lot of kids who are tall. They're tall and thin. Remember, average is average is average in America. And the average in America is heavier than the average in France, than in Germany, you know, and in South America. Why? Because we're a fatter society and our kids are bigger. So when you're looking at that, you've got to look at these numbers and say, what do they apply to? And they apply to, quote, a cross-section. But the cross-section doesn't take into account the fact that a lot of kids are overweight. So 25 in the percentile for height, you said, and 10th.
Yes.
So he's a small kid, you know, one of the shorter kids, and he's thin. As long as he keeps up and he's eating stuff, feed him the food that he likes, try to enlarge his appetite a little bit. But some kids are just finicky eaters until they get older. The issue is he losing weight or is he maintaining his weight? If he maintains his weight and he's like this and his mom was thin, then that just me the way that he is as a teenager. And often they will grow out of it and start gaining weight, or they'll just remain being thin. We have to remember the 5 to 10% of the population throughout their life actually wants to be heavier. You know, and then we make jokes, oh, I'll give you some of my weight. But the reality is they're as concerned about their weight on the low end of the scale as people who enter the upper end. So feed in the foods he like. And I joked about bacon, but frankly, bacon is a high caloric food. It has a lot of fat. It's got a little bit of protein. And if you can use it so that he'll actually eat a hamburger and he'll get some food into him, by all means do it. Is it ideal? No. But when you're raising children, sometimes you engage in an unideal practice to get them to be healthy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I don't think I'd be that concerned as long as he's not losing weight. What's his doc say?
He hasn't gained weight, and sometimes he does go down 5 pounds or something.
Uh-huh.
So the doctor told Christy to start giving him a children's Ensure every day.
Uh-huh. Is she doing that? Is she doing a children?
Yes, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. You could also give an adult Ensure. There's no reason not to give a children's. An adult Ensure is like 220, 250 calories. I mean, he's a kid. He's 13 years of age. No reason to spend more money on it. And by the way, when you're buying Ensure Boost, or my favorite, which is Glucerna, it has less, fewer carbohydrates. When you buy it, look around and get the cheapest.
Okay.
I did this with a patient of mine in the office. I went to the internet. I looked up a number of stores. We're on public radio, so I won't mention what they are, but they're different large big box stores and local grocery stores. And the difference in a package of it was either 12 or 16, but the difference was like $3 to $4. In the package. So when you're going to buy it at the cheapest place because it's exactly the same.
Okay.
I mean, I always want to, if I'm going to buy something, I want to do that. But yeah, if he's going to drink an Ensure, like a chocolate Ensure, put a little ice cream in it, drink it, you know, make it caloric. And if he's going to do that every day, that's fine. And ice cream supports Wisconsin. And that counts.
Yes, it does.
Do you have
any thoughts on the brain scans that they do? Would that be worthwhile doing?
Not at all. There's no reason to do a brain scan. How's he doing in school?
He's doing pretty good. His grades were good last year, but it's a struggle. I mean, it's a battle every day.
But he's doing good. You're winning the battle. He's doing okay. Do not take him off his meds. He'll have more trouble not on his meds, having trouble in school, than he is with the food. Ice cream, bit of Boost, and bacon. It's the ice cream and bacon diet.
He'll love it. He'll love it.
Maybe Tom and I should go on the ice cream and bacon diet.
There you go.
Little chocolate candy. That's what we're going to do. Forget these turkey hummus sliders that are healthy that we're going to discuss. Let's go to chocolate and bacon. You take care. Keep up the good work, Grandma.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We appreciate the call. Thanks a lot. Before the break now, Zorba, let's check in again with your favorite backseat drivers, the Grammar Police.
I have people stopping me on the street sometimes.
Singing that old...
Well, I think they're correcting my grammar. I think we need the punctuation police to follow up for the grammar police.
Speaking about correcting your grammar, Zorba, this one is actually from the pronunciation police.
Oh, no, gosh.
Gary from Iron River, Wisconsin, sent us the following email. Dr. Zorba and Tom, when it comes to mascarpone, you fall into the same trap that many Americans do. It is not pronounced mascarpone as you regularly pronounce it. Look at how it's spelled and where the R really is in the word. It's more like...
I know where the R is. I can look at it.
It's more like mascarpone. And Zorba, Gary was kind enough to point us to an audio sample of the correct pronunciation of this word, so let's hear that now.
Mascarpone.
Oh, mascarpone. I got it. Mascarpone. You got to notice the trill? Let's play it again, Carol. Play it again.
Mascarpone.
Mascarpone. Oh, and you know what? You know, when I say it, I'm using my hands. I'm doing mascarpone.
Okay, Zorba, now let's hear that clip in the context of Genuine's steamy 1996 smash hit song, Pony. And Zorba, before you ask me why we're doing this, here's your answer. I don't know why we're doing this.
Mascarpone.
I'll never forget it now. It's indelible in my brain.
I don't remember that in the song at all. If you'd like to join the Evergreen.
It was the sub context. That's indelibly in my brain, just like Louis Louis. I will never, ever forget that song.
Just like what?
Louis Louis. Louis Louis.
Oh, yeah.
It's indelibly in your brain, too.
If you'd like to join the ever-growing and ever-persnickety grammar police, pony up and send us an email at
Zorba@WRPR.org.
Our tasty recipe coming up, along with more of your calls, of course, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again, if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, turkey hummus sliders.
That's right, hummus. Is it hummus or hummus?
Oh, I always said hummus.
Oh, sometimes I say hummus. I really want to, maybe it's hummus.
A listener will correct me.
Maybe it's hummus.
I bet you're right.
I hope somebody will correct us and give us the right pronunciation. I really don't know. I need somebody's help. Well, when I think of sliders, what do you think of? Do you ever think of sliders?
I never in my life have thought of a slider.
I think of sliders when I'm in Chicago, coming back from O'Hare Airport. And if I go out of my way for about less than a minute, I can end up at a White Castle and have some of those sliders. And they kind of remind me of my childhood. You know, they're little, they're thin. They're kind of like pasty, little burgers. And, you know, one chump, two chumps, and they're down there. And, like, you know what? It makes you feel good. Makes you feel, if you say so. However, they are not really healthy. So the questions with sliders, which have actually entered America more, is they're really small little sandwiches in their taste. Mm-hmm. So they're not an appetizer, and they're not a full sandwich. They're somewhere in between.
Got it.
And even in my local grocery store, Bill's in Oregon, they have slider buns, which means that they definitely have mainstreamed America. And this uses turkey, which we know is much better than beef. Mm-hmm. It uses hummus, which is a delicious taste. And it has the word slider in it, which is a good word. So if you want a great recipe, try this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now we have to do the recipe.
Are we done yet? Okay.
Okay. Start out with a cucumber. If you can get an English cucumber, those are the tall, thin cucumbers that have more cuke in it and less seed. Mm-hmm.
Okay, one cucumber.
Diced. And if you don't have an English cucumber, it should be the thinnest cucumber you can get it.
Okay.
Wonder if they call our cucumbers American cucumbers in England. That's interesting. Half cup of crumbled feta cheese.
Half cup crumbled feta cheese.
How old were you when you first ate feta cheese, do you think?
I have no idea.
I mean, I'm sure I certainly was out of college before I had feta.
In fact, if I've ever had feta cheese, I don't remember.
You know what it is? It may be that you are in your mid-80s when you first had feta cheese.
Way back then.
Two tablespoonfuls of red wine vinegar.
Two big tea red wine vinegar.
If you have mint, a teaspoon of dried mint. Very few people have dried mint in their spice cabinet. I happen to be one of those who has dried mint.
A little tea, dried mint.
Four tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil.
Four big tea, extra virgin olive oil.
Are you going to use kosher salt and freshly ground pepper? Kosher salt or the salt that you basically grind that's sea salt?
Yeah. Kosher salt, freshly ground pepper, too.
1.5 pounds of ground turkey.
Pound and a half ground turkey.
Okay. A cup of hummus, preferably spicy or roasted red pepper hummus. It's about a 7 ounce container.
Cup of hummus, preferably spicy or roasted red bell pepper.
And they come in a 7 ounce container, by the way.
Okay.
I wonder why they're 7 ounces instead of 8 ounces. I know why. They can sell it and not use as much. And you notice I'm commenting on this recipe as we go
along. Okay.
It just kind of gives me some feeling.
Yeah.
But I think I want to make the whole thing more interesting to people. It's a commentary. It's a recipe commentary.
So far, it's the most interesting thing that I've heard on this recipe.
Is my commentary. All right, moving on. Half cup chopped fresh parsley.
Half a cup chopped fresh parsley.
2 teaspoons ground coriander.
2 little tea ground coriander.
2 cloves of garlic.
2 cloves garlic.
Okay. You're going to have 16 either mini pita pockets, because you're going to do pita pockets, or you could put it on a slider bread if you want to. Pita pockets would be great, the ones that are split open, but the mini ones. Warm them up, too, if you're going to use those.
That sounds neat. Pita pockets. Doesn't it?
You like the way it sounds. I like the way it tastes.
16 mini pita pockets, preferably whole wheat, split open and warm.
You did a great job of that. You're really getting into this recipe. And 2 to 3 plum tomatoes if you have them sliced.
2 to 3 plum tomatoes sliced.
Now, you may look at this and say there are a lot of ingredients because you know what? There are a lot of ingredients.
Right.
Okay. Number one, toss the cucumber, feta, vinegar, mint, tablespoonful of olive oil, pinch of salt and pepper in a bowl. Toss it, cover it, put it back in the fridge. Mix the turkey, half a cup of hummus, the parsley, garlic, and coriander in a bowl. Season generously with pepper, a little bit of salt if you want to. Dampen your hands. Shape the mixture into 16 small patties about 1/2 inch thick. Then heat the patties in 1.5 tablespoonfuls of olive oil in either a nice cast iron skillet or a nonstick skillet. Medium heat. Add half the patties. Cook them until they're browned, about 2 minutes each side, half the others. In other words, don't crowd them together and cook them once again in some olive oil. So figure out how you're going to cook these. But basically, it's 1.5 minutes roughly on each side. The turkey has to be cooked.
Mm-hmm.
Mix the remaining half cup of hummus with a splash of hot water in a bowl. Spread some of the hummus on the inside of each pita. So there's going to be hummus in the pita. There's going to be a tomato slice, a turkey patty, which has hummus in it,
mm-hmm.
and some of the cucumber mixture, and you're done.
Yeah. You didn't say pita pockets.
I didn't say pita pockets. How many pita pockets did Peter Pocket and Peter Pan pick? If you want a copy of this pita pocket recipe, turkey hummus slider pita pocket recipe, go to Zorba at WPR.org. You'll find that recipe. You'll also find very important information on Tom and I, and you'll be able to see some serious information.
Oh, good. We try to be serious on this radio program.
Zorba Pass.
800-462-7413 is our number. That's 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener in Knoxville, Tennessee, is next. Hi.
Hi, Zorba and Tom. Thanks for talking to me today.
Sure. How can we help?
I thought I might describe myself as being from the coast, because that will give you the context for my question today.
Mm-hmm. But Knoxville isn't the coast.
It's not. And I started out on the West Coast, grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and had the great privilege of going down to the docks as a kid with my folks and buying crab off the boats.
Mm-hmm.
We'd take it home, cook it, take the meat out of it, and eat it. Fabulous.
Mm.
But from the time I was about 6 or 7, when I was taking the meat out of the shell, my hands would swell about 2 times normal size.
Mm.
They would ache. and that would last for 2 or 3 hours, and then they would go down. Then I moved to the East Coast. I moved to New England as an adult. And lobster is in New England, mm-hmm. and I had the wonderful opportunity to eat lobster there. And once again, when I had to take the meat out of the shell of the lobster, my hands would swell about twice normal size, mm-hmm. wow. and they would ache. Hmm. And my question is, what might cause something like this? Will it get worse? Because I know some allergies do, and... Mm-hmm. Is there anything I can do for it besides have someone else take the meat out of the shell for me?
Hmm. Well, now, is that your reason for moving to Tennessee to get away, to get away from this?
That would be a bit of an overreaction, I think.
That's it. But Tom is very insightful. He usually can get right to the case of what happens when you're from one place to another. Well, clearly. Now, when you have you eaten lobster or crab, where you haven't taken it out of the shell, like gone to a restaurant where they serve it as a meal?
Yes, I have. When I've taken it out of the shell myself, I've had the problem. When I've gone to a restaurant and said, "Look, I have this weird thing. Mm-hmm. Could you take it out of the shell for me?" Then I don't have any issue, and I don't have any problem eating shellfish.
Okay, so it's not an allergic reaction, a typical allergic reaction, because if so, you wouldn't be able to eat it. And often when it comes to shellfish, it can be very specific, or it can be very sensitive to iodine. There are a variety of things. And I'll never forget a really good friend, our best friends, and I was serving a wonderful scallop dish, which was a delicious scallop dish, and we had garlic in it and everything. And a friend of ours who was eating did not know that she was allergic to scallops because this was her first episode. And as we're sitting at the table, her face is becoming red, and then her whole face is beginning to swell up. Mm. And then she became a little bit short of breath, which sort of made us anxious. Being a doctor... My good friend being a doctor, we noticed, hey, we have to do something about this. Smart, even though we had a drink, we still were with it. And I got her some Benadryl and she was fine. But she's allergic to scallops, but she's not allergic to other shellfish. So it's very specific. She can have lobster, she can have shrimp, she can have fish, but she can't have scallops. So you're obviously allergic to something in the shell.
Okay.
It's a shell-specific allergy, and we don't think of shells as being the allergy because we think of the meat of the of the seafood as actually being the allergy. But clearly, there's something in the shell that's actually doing it, and there must be some component in both of the shells that are doing it too. So the answer obviously is to move to Knoxville. obviously, you solved the problem by moving to Knoxville. Unfortunately, refrigeration and FedEx mitigated the problem because you can get lobster and crab in Knoxville. It's not like the good old days when you couldn't get those things. So I'm afraid you failed in the long run. But the answer is, yeah, you are obviously very sensitive to something like that. Now, let's assume, for instance, that you were in the business of doing something like this. You were an oyster shucker, which may be that, or something like that. You would then have to take Benadryl or something of that nature to see whether or not you could mitigate it. But it's something in the shell. Stay away from it. Enjoy the seafood when you can get it. And enjoy your time in Tennessee.
Thank you so much. I appreciate
you. You're welcome.
Appreciate the call, too, at 800-462-7413.
You know, it was a bit of an overreaction to leave the coast and come to Tennessee.
Hey, whatever works.
Whatever works.
Now, before the break, Zorba, please unholster your gavel and powder up your parliamentary wig. Right. Time again for the segment we call Judge Zorba.
I'm testing the gavel to see if it works.
Yeah, I heard. The following email came to us from Paulette in Spokane, Washington. She writes, "Since you're so knowledgeable about so many health issues, can you tell me what you know about muscle testing? I have a friend who believes it's the answer to almost every health problem." You get
the answer to almost every health problem. Now, we know before we go any further, You have a feeling, just a little perspective as to what this is.
Yeah. Okay. You get muscle tested, and then you know exactly what supplements to take to heal whatever illness you may have.
Can it
be that simplistic? And who are the people that are doing the muscle testing?
Well, we know who the people are who are doing the muscle testing. There are entrepreneurs who want to take money out of your wallet. We know that for sure. We know they're doing it for a living. They're not doing it for the benefit of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of muscle testing so you can cure everything that aches you and what supplements you're going to take and everything will be all better and everyone lives happily ever after. It's just like a Disney film. Of course, it's snake oil. It doesn't do anything. Life is not that simple. You don't just take a supplement and get rid of cancer and heart disease and things like that. We know a lot about things, but we know that supplements are not the answer to everything. They may be the answer to some things. And they may be useful, but save your money.
Have a case you need settled? Judge Zorba is always happy to flex his judiciary muscles. Just post it on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up, another interesting topic to discuss. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, brain function after surgery?
Right, right. Some very interesting things. You know, one of the things as you get older that we all worry about, I'm older, but as you get older, you worry about it more, is Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. And Alzheimer's is only one form of dementia, about half of all dementia. The other half is cardiovascular and a whole bunch of other things that are lumped together. So when we think of Alzheimer's, we kind of think of all forms of dementia. This study, new study, British Medical Journal, very important, looked at specifically what the risk was of having surgery and anesthesia and hospitalization. Study came out of the UK, Great Britain, called the Whitehall Study and the Whitehall 2 Study. 70,000 British servants, civil servants in the first study, roughly 70,000 British servants in the second study. And these are people that periodically get medical examinations, fill out questionnaires, and once every 5 years they have a cognitive assessment. In other words, IQ test, what we would call it, IQ test. How are you doing? What are you doing? How do you remember things? And they looked for risk factors of what are risk factors that come because we worry about memory loss as we get older. And they discovered a very important risk factor. The risk factor is repeated hospitalizations for surgery. In other words, the more surgery you have as an older adult, the more likely you are to lose some IQ points from that surgery. Now, is it the surgery that does it? Is it the anesthesia that does it? Is it a combination of those things? We don't actually know exactly why. But it's very important because it is a fixed defect. Now, what does that mean? Well, when we worry about Alzheimer's, we worry about, oh, my God, I'm going downhill. I'm going to have Alzheimer's. I'm not going to remember things. And my mom had Alzheimer's. She truly had Alzheimer's. And eventually, she couldn't say my name. She knew me. She didn't know Penny. She didn't know the kids. That's different. A fixed defect is post-surgery, I may not be able to remember as much. Now, that means we should have less surgery. We should only have general surgery and anesthesia when we need it. But this is comforting to some people with memory loss to know it's not necessarily going to get worse. It's a fixed defect.
I have an excuse.
You have an excuse. That's right. Well, you've had surgery.
Yes,
you've had
I know.
You've had a pneumonia.
Yep.
Hospitalization makes a difference. You dinged your head. You know, when you fell down, you dinged your head. And so you worry at times, right, that, that your memory is not the same. But it doesn't mean your memory is going to continue to get worse and worse and worse because it's a stepwise fixed defect, just like somebody may have a stroke. So the issue is surgeries make a different, anesthesia makes a different. The less surgery you have and the less and if you can possibly stay in less anesthesia and do it under a local, that's a better way to go. And this is very important information for seniors.
Let's see if I can remember that number. 800-462-7413. Is that, I get it?
Yes, you did. You got it right. You got it right, baby.
800-462-7413. Our next caller, Zorba, is a listener in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Hi.
Hey, how are you? Love the show.
Good.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
How can we help?
Thank you.
So I'm calling for on behalf of my wife. She's 34. In November, she started noticing she was having severe hair breakage. So about 4 to 5 inches from the root, her hair would break off in clumps.
Hmm.
And it's she had always had very thick, you know, thick long blonde hair, and it's breaking off, and it's caused her a lot of distress. She did have cysts and fibroids and endometriosis, and had a hysterectomy in March. Went to see her hairstylist, who said he says it's not from overprocessing because then it would be falling out at the root.
Mm-hmm.
But her dermatologist said it is from overprocessing, and I wanted a second opinion.
Sure. So okay. So the hairstylist said no. The doctor said yes. What does the hairstylist do to her hair?
Well, she does. She has. She's bleached it for years, so mm-hmm. it was a blonde. She does color it with a all-natural organic coloring,
mm-hmm.
But that's pretty much what she's been doing. She's been coloring it for years.
Uh-huh. So the dermatologist said this might actually be the problem because it may be. So hair has keratin in it. Keratin is actually what gives hair our. It's what actually makes give it its luster. It's got other things in it. Obviously, it's a different part of our mm-hmm. body. But the problem is whether or not she should actually go to something that's different. I think you always have to look at chemicals that you put on and say, what's going on? Is this the right chemical or not the right chemical? It may not be mm-hmm. over-processing. It may be the process that the hairstylist, you know, at the beauty shop is using to actually do that. And switching to a different, you know, a different thing to actually color her hair may actually answer the question. Because, you know, when we put stuff on the hair, obviously we're changing the structure. Well, we're not necessarily – well, no, we are changing the structure. When you change the color of the hair, you're changing its structure in some way. And we know, for instance, if you had a permanent – and permanents were very, very popular for a long time – that over time the hair would actually be dysfunctional if you had too many permanents. And so they had to limit the number of permanents and so on because of that situation. So I would stick – I would go on the side of the dermatologist and say you may have to use a different product on your hair if you want it to stay the way that it is. I don't think she necessarily has to stop doing stuff to her hair, although there may be a time that she actually does for a while where the hair recovers. I would say to the stylist, I want to use something different. I don't want to use the same thing. Or I would go to a different stylist. That's what I would do. I wouldn't say it's not the chemical she's putting on the hair. I would say, what's the obvious thing? Something's going on with the hair. I'm putting stuff on my hair other than soap and water and conditioner. It's going to affect mm-hmm. the hair. And I would assume that if it's breaking off in the middle there, it's adversely affecting. She needs a different hair product.
Okay. So because we had read that we think that she had the polycystic ovarian syndrome and mm-hmm. hair loss was one of the side effects.
But that's at the root, if I'm not correct, when she has polycystic ovarian syndrome. I mean, you have to look, but I believe that it's at the root. You'd have to ask the dermatologist. I don't know offhand, but I think that's at the root. And this is not at the root. So it's not polycystic ovarian syndrome. Is she on something for that, like metformin?
No. After the hysterectomy, she didn't have to take any more meds for that.
Okay. Now, the other thing is certain meds can do this. Was she on steroids for a while, prednisone?
I believe so.
Because steroids, because steroids can do this, and that it can have an adverse effect on the hair for 1 to 2 years after you're off steroids if she was on high dose steroids.
I think she does get a steroid injection in her back because she has chronic back issues.
steroids can do this. If you look up Cushing's syndrome, which is too much steroid in the body, which is usually produced, you know, internally, look up Cushing's syndrome and look at the symptoms. She might, I mean, this can be a symptom of too much steroids in her body. And if she's getting injections in her back, and they're called depot steroids, where the steroid is staying in her back for a period of time, the injection, that might be part of the problem, or it might be the problem.
Interesting. I know we never even thought about that.
Steroids. Check that out.
Yeah. We will.
Well, good. That's why you called. You got a second opinion. And in fact, I gave you a third opinion. Was a twofer, wasn't it, Tom?
Yep.
Yeah. For the price of the one.
do you want my opinion?
That's a threefer.
No, you don't. You don't want my
We'll stick with the twofer. Thanks for your call.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
800-462-7413, our number. And before the next call, Zorba, we've been doing this show for over 25 years, and I rarely disagree with you. But as you know, from time to time, our listeners take issue with something they heard on the show. So it's time again for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc.
The following email came to us from Jerry in Buffalo, New York. She writes, Dr. Zorba, my significant other was listening to your show, and the only thing he mentioned to me was the study you quoted that showed people who vacationed had outcomes as good as those who quit smoking and ate healthfully. I heard the show, too, and wondered about the message that story sent. My significant other is overweight and has a hard time walking. He almost always chooses the less healthful option on the menu, including red meat and French fries. Now, he'll think he doesn't need to do anything to improve his health.
You know, listen to the radio, you can just believe anything. I think that was a bit of an overstep on what I actually said on the show. I mean, I talked about a study that showed vacations were one of the risk factors in heart disease and stroke. I didn't say that taking a vacation, if you take a vacation on a regular basis,
you can eat anything you want.
You can eat anything you want, smoke cigarettes, not exercise, and drink a lot of booze. I didn't say that.
Do you disagree with something Zorba said? Well, now's your chance to let him know. Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones now, Zorba at 800-462-7413. A listener with us in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. How are you?
Good. Very good. Thanks. How can we help?
Thank you for taking my question. I wanted to know, what is a safe dose of mercury?
Well, there's no safe dose. That's the answer. The answer is we don't know. So the answer is there's no safe dose. So our goal was to get mercury out of the environment. So we don't use mercury thermometers. We actually have better thermometers anyway. We don't use mercury blood pressure cuffs. They were very big, not because the mercury leached out, but because if they broke, you know, they were glass, and if they broke, there'd be mercury around. We no longer play with mercury in schools. I remember when I was a kid, you get a drop of mercury and you'd put it over a quarter and it would shine really, really well. And we don't eat too much fish with mercury. So you're concerned because of consumption of fish, I assume?
Well, I heard you advise a caller that she could eat fish 2 times a week, and I just started doing the math and thought, over the course of a year, over the course of a lifetime, that's why I came up with the question.
Well, first of all, if you look at the USDA and their recommendations, which is certain, you know, eating fish and certain fish twice a week seems to be okay. That's based on what we think is an amount of mercury that is okay. And it's also assuming every fish has the mercury in it. It's not as if every fish has mercury. It's that some of the fish have mercury and some of the fish do not have mercury. So you're not really having a regular consumption. So I base that really on those kind of guidelines. But you bring up a good point. There's another point that's very important here. A number of people take alternative medicine that may have mercury in it. So, for instance, Tibetan alternative medicine, some of the Tibetan medicine that's manufactured actually has mercury in the medicine. They actually put mercury in because mercury was thought to be a noble metal that was useful to make your body better. I mean, it was shiny, and so it's actually still put in a variety of medications and not necessarily listed as an ingredient because a number of traditional medications do not list their ingredients. And they're not regulated by the FDA. You don't necessarily buy them in the U.S. So we have to look at mercury as a spot with that. One of the things that people can also do if they're worried about mercury is you can get a mercury level in your body. You can take a blood test, see whether or not you have too much mercury, and that can determine that too.
I see. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thanks for bringing that up. That's a really, really, really good point.
1-800-462-7413, our number. And before we head out today, Zorba, isn't it nice when someone tells us we're doing a good job? The following email came to us from a listener named Patricia. She writes, "Zorba, I just wanted to thank you. Last year, I decided I needed a lifestyle change instead of a diet. After listening to you, I decided to try the Mediterranean diet because it sounded like something I could live with after the weight loss was over. I watched my portions and my calories and lost a little over 100 pounds, slowly, over a year."
Wow.
I also started walking every day until I got from 500 steps to 15,000 steps a day.
Oh, my goodness. What a lifestyle change.
I've kept the weight off and the walking up for about a year now. I can't thank you enough. Way to go, Doc. You make a difference in more lives than you know.
Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful. Actually, that's a 10 on the email and communication scale. That's a 10.
Great? Yeah.
And that really is the bottom line reason that we're here, to try to give people information so that they can change their lives. So thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of my heart. And Tom, thanks you too.
I do. Has Dr. Zorba helped you? Share your story with us. Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or, of course, through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidrum. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more information on Dr. Zorba Pastor and to listen to current or past episodes, go to ZorbaPastor.org. There you can subscribe to the weekly podcast, and you will find the show archive, Zorba's favorite recipes, his healthy living articles, and other helpful tips heard on the show. That's ZorbaPastor.org.